Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rabona podcast. Once again, I'm your host, co-host Musa Konga, joined by Ryan Hunt and Michael De Silva. It's back from his travels.
Yeah, damn right, co-host.
Hey. Part time.
Oh, you guys don't miss a trick. We're going to be discussing Manchester City against Chelsea in the Men's League Cup final. Ryan will be having a great interview with Susie Rack of The Guardian to discuss the Women's League Cup final. We'll also be talking to comedian and Manchester United fan Nish Kumar about Solskjaer, the story so far.
Looking forward to that.
But first of all, let's talk about player power. Let's talk about Chelsea in the League Cup final.
Can I just say, I was watching Dortmund Leverkusen.
You can say.
And I turned over from that to watch the last 5 minutes of extra time of Chelsea Man City and the shootout. I think I timed that absolutely perfectly.
Yeah, literally,
it was just all kicking off.
You could have turned on in the with 3 minutes to go in extra time and not missed anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about Kepa.
That's extraordinary. And can I say your timing? It was so good when you tuned in. I almost feel like you're like the Eagles in Lord of the Rings. Just turn up. Oh, like, it's not hot enough yet. Let's wait for Mordor to start kicking off. Yeah. And the Eagles rock up. You're like the Eagles.
I do feel like I timed it perfectly. Yeah, I mean, I saw Kepa waving his arms about, basically just saying no. I thought it was, Sarri said afterwards that he was injured and it was a misunderstanding. I'm not really buying that, but that was my first reaction, because I thought that he's not refusing to go off. So I thought he was just signaling that he's okay. But then it seemed like
it's a crazy power move by Kepa not to come off, because if you look at what Sarri was planning, bring on Caballero, who actually, company said afterwards, this guy's a penalty specialist, a shootout specialist. So not only is he a shootout specialist, he also knows Man City players. Sarri must have been thinking the whole afternoon, that's the tragedy of it. Ah, here's my card. Here's my card to play. Here's my ace in the hole.
But it's also an admission from Chelsea that they have overspent on Kepa, because he's a £71 million goalkeeper who's not apparently good enough to save penalties.
Which was proven. Well, listen, let's get into it, because Max Rushton, shout out at Guardian podcast, actually tweeted he should just take off somebody else for Caballero. That was actually the most brilliant solution if he'd done that.
You can't do that though.
Sarri could have taken off a different outfield player.
No, you can't. You can only have one outfield player on the pitch. One goalkeeper on the pitch. Unless you play him outfield, but then he can't go in goal.
Really?
So unless Caballero is a dynamite penalty taker.
Is that true?
I'm pretty
sure. The laws of the game.
Otherwise, why wouldn't you just play two goalkeepers?
Well, you wouldn't put them both in goal.
Yeah, but...
at the same time.
Yeah, so one of them would have to go in goal.
Yeah. That was the thing. He said, just bring him on as an outfield player and then, like, swap him. It's the kind of thing that Cruyff might have done, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine Cruyff doing... I'm not sure about that.
Really? Well, that's what he said. That's what he said. But you can cut this, but I think that's what he said.
It's good chat.
It is good chat. No, but I think I sort of thought, actually, well, why not? Because he's clearly defying his authority.
Yeah.
He's humiliated him. And the thing about this was that the players did not say, get off the pitch.
You know, I think
that
this is where...
That would have been the most painful thing.
This is where Azpilicueta, I think, as captain, should have just gone...
Them.
He should
all
have gone
them.
Over to Kepa and said, look, mate, get off.
I've just clarified the rules.
Yeah.
So, yes, a team may put two players with goalkeeping skills on the pitch, but only one of them can go in goal. So if he brought Caballero on, he still wouldn't be able to go in goal. So he couldn't come on in the goalkeeping with his gloves on and then just be like, all right, I'm going in goal now, I don't think.
But then after extra time, they could swap them over and put Caballero in goal.
Yeah, but you can't, but I don't think you can do that. You can't do that because otherwise, say for example, you could just make another substitution as well or whatever.
Oh, I don't know actually. Maybe because it hasn't been tested. Like the penalty, this feels like the penalty rule when like Cruyff does the side foot and until, because Cruyff basically found a loophole in the rule.
Yeah.
But having all that said though, and this is the crucial thing I think, the fact is it wasn't just the captain's job to tell Kepa to get off. Where were the rest of the players in this? Yeah. They've played for 2 hours on the same pitch and they must be looking at it thinking, because then that's when the loyalties crystallise. And they weren't in Sarri's favour. And at the end of the game, they kind of clustered around Kepa, but they all looked like fools because this thing with Aguero's penalty was, I mean, can I say this as well? The egos of so many Chelsea players were exposed in that shootout.
Mm.
Like, Jorginho's skip.
That looked very silly.
Because it was telegraphed. Yeah. When he does it before, he disguises it. But this time, it was like
it was
clear
obvious.
Where he was going to hit it.
Yeah.
And then Kepa does this like big crazy dancing on the line. And then puts it under, Aguero goes under his arm.
Yeah.
And if he just stood still, he would have saved it. I mean, it's... Yeah.
The thing about the situation is, it was just a complete mess.
It was.
All round.
Yeah.
So you don't know what's being relayed in terms of communication. If the Chelsea coaches think that he's injured and then he says he's fine, it's fine. If Sarri actually has a strategy there where he's all along, if it's going to go to penalties, he was going to put Caballero in, then I don't think any player, it doesn't look good when any player disobeys their manager like that ever. If he's told Kepa before the game that that's going to happen, then yeah, Kepa's well out of order. But it just, I don't know what the, do you know what I mean?
I've never disputed. Because look, here's the thing. It wasn't like you said, are you okay to come off? Like they'll consult you. They're like, you know, if you're being taken off because you're injured, the coach will say, look, are you okay to continue? But here's the thing. It wasn't like he said, no, I'm fine to continue, and he stepped back. Zola came off the bench, and Zola is the dude. Zola's like the nice guy. If Zola gets involved, you know you're in trouble.
Yeah.
It's like the wolf in Pulp Fiction. Like when he comes out, you're like, this has to be sorted. And Zola did not have the clout. That was the worst thing. Well, because then, here's the thing, because if Zola's going to succeed, Sarri, which I think would be a mistake, but I don't think Zola's that great a manager. You've already seen that he doesn't have the clout to like get that dude off in the heat of the moment. That to me was like a major indictment.
I think the saddest or the most telling part of all of this is that Sarri was unable to even say, be honest about what happened in the press conference afterwards. He felt like his position at the club isn't strong enough to be able to say, no, Kepa defied me and I'm really angry. He said he had this excuse, which we all know is just a cover up. And I think Sarri's stock has fallen at the club perhaps even further than we all realised.
Do you know what was really harsh as well? He couldn't even have a cigarette. Oh, keeping a person's cigarettes away from him at a time like that.
Oh, it was really, no, I have to say, it all
that's why he went off down the tunnel.
It
was like, I need a cig.
It was so relatable. I mean, he actually should just do a cigarette advert at this point. Just in the tunnel, like just... For those moments, because it would be hilarious, you know, for those moments when you absolutely nothing else will do.
When your goalkeeper defies you.
Oh my goodness.
But this is the thing, right? So anyway.
He'll be like, Arrizabalaga, I haven't heard that name in years.
But like, the thing about it is that they can still make the substitution though.
Yeah.
So if you say, if they're on the touchline and they are desperate for him to come off for whatever reason,
right,
then they can still be, say to the fourth official, no, we're making the sub. File the papers, they do the, they put the numbers up and just hook him.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, they'd have to physically remove him from the field.
Well, no, because if his number goes up, it's on the ref then to make sure he goes off. Like, you make a substitution, you know, and the players kind of walk off really slowly and the ref comes over and is like, come on, mate, I'm going to book you.
But I said this on Twitter, I said, there's a moment in that sort of episode, we can almost see the referee going like, should I send this to VAR? Like, you can see it. It's almost like he's thinking, player's broken down. It's controversial. Like, you can almost see him thinking. Because at the very end, there's this weird signal he does when he goes, play on. You know, like when a VAR decision's been made and the ref does something, he goes, no penalty, no goal. And he does this. He did the same movement with his arms that you do after a VAR decision. He literally goes like, safe. Like, it's hilarious.
Yeah, but in my head, it kind of looked like he was just like, right, I've had enough of this. All of you, just get on with
no,
it.
No, I don't think it was that. I think it's different. I think he was traumatized. I think in that moment, he experienced some form of a trauma because he didn't just go, no, let's just play on. Yeah. He was like, safe. Listen, because I'm not trying to have a go at Chelsea because it's the situation. I saw a Chelsea fan on Twitter trying to play it down. He was going, oh, no. Oh, you know what? That was just like, you know, there'll be a couple of like firm words, maybe dressing room, but after 5 minutes, they'll sort it. I said, they won't. No. It's gone.
No.
Do you know what? It would have been fine. I think it would have been fine if Kepa hadn't winked at the camera.
I missed that. Did he
win? That was just pure, I mean, SAS levels went like sky
I'm
high.
Telling you, I think there's a part of me that, I think I said this before, I think he was doing it for the gram. I think that the consciousness of like, I mean, he was based like a social media villain. Mm. That weird goal line stuff, you're trying to psych out Aguero on the line. Mate, it's Aguero. And then the weird thing was, and Edison got away with it because City won, but let's actually save a bit of beef for Edison, because when Hazard walked up to the spot, Edison was standing. So Hazard walks up to the area and Hazard is standing, you know, Edison's standing on the penalty spot. So Hazard has to like back him up. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
And then Hazard chips him.
Yeah.
That's the ball over his head when he's virtually... The great thing about the Panenka is that Edison goes down quite late.
Yeah.
And the chip is so beautifully struck that when Edison... It's so funny because the ball goes so slowly and so high, Edison has time to fall down and get back up.
Yeah. And it's still going in the air. I was enjoying the FIFA-esque TV angles for that penalty shootout.
Yeah. There was a lot of goalkeeper antics in shootouts this weekend. Yeah. Karen Barnsley got booked in the women's...
Really?
Final
for doing what? Come off the line?
But basically, she was just walking right out, slowing everything down, and all of Arsenal's penalty takers were ready to go before she was even in her own six-yard box. Mm. And then she basically eventually got booked for it.
It'd be really fascinating to chart the evolution of how much goalkeepers move in shootouts, because in the old days, they'd just be on the line and ready. But now, there's so much interaction and drama, because goalkeepers have realised, I'm sure they've done all the research and been like, the longer it takes someone to shoot, they'd looked at all the stats and been like, if you delay the penalty by X seconds, the chance of missing goes up by X percent. I'm sure they've done all the stats.
Anything that messes with anyone's rhythm.
Yeah. You know, and it shouldn't be allowed, really.
No, it shouldn't. It shouldn't.
But yeah, so first, Pep Guardiola becomes the first Man City manager to retain a major trophy.
A major trophy.
That's the definition of it. It's a major trophy.
I just said a major trophy. I'm repeating it.
It's a good job. It's a visual format, an audio format, not a visual one, because otherwise.
I just saw. No, my headphones are a bit. I just thought, major trophy. Yeah.
Major trophy with a question mark. Major.
Just going to enter some subtitles here.
Do you know what? I have enough trouble in this podcast as it is without my words being taken out of context.
It's from the United corner over there.
Yeah.
Speaking of United.
Yeah.
What a massive point that was.
Do you know what? Actually, can I say this? For the first time in months, I've always tipped Liverpool for the league. I mean, this season. This was the first time I thought to myself, you know what? They need to be careful. They might not do this.
Oof.
And I say this because the criticism of the front three, I think, is unfair. I think that actually what happens is when you come up against a very well-organised defensive system, as Liverpool did against Bayern, who play very well defensively, and United, then you need more from the midfield. And the creativity midfield, I think, just needs a bit of a look. If Liverpool are going to push through, I still think they have the quality, of course, to win. Mm. But how many goals they scored this season? 59. That's decent, but City have 74. And the one thing that Liverpool did not want this season to turn into is a shootout.
Yeah.
And it's turning into a shootout, and they do not want that problem. Mm-hmm. And the game against United, and I'm talking about Liverpool here because I want to not be United-centric and give them credit. And I feel bad when I see players like Salah get criticised for not finding space, because there wasn't that much space. And in those matches...
Luke Shaw had a great game.
It's a fine player. In those games, the centre midfield have to make the difference, carry the ball into the final third, release shots from distance. De Gea wasn't really tested. So I think there's a little bit of rejigging Liverpool have to do at this point. And step up in that sense.
They've had circumstances this week, though. You know, they had injury problems against Bayern. Playing Fabinho at the back, and he did really well.
Yeah.
Firmino went off on the weekend against United. And actually...
Yeah. Who didn't go off in the first half game?
Like,
wild.
I think the ball was in play for about 5 minutes in that first half. But I kind of think Klopp overplayed how United's injuries affected Liverpool's rhythm a little bit, but I can kind of understand it. I was really surprised he didn't bring on Shaqiri for Firmino.
Right.
And I think when the only shot on target they had in the first half actually came from Sturridge, though, when he had that P-roller from 25 yards that De Gea saved.
I mean, I like Sturridge a lot, but the problem with Sturridge is it's the Zlatan problem. When you have a player like that, a fixed nine, then the attack becomes predictable. You know who to pick up.
Yeah, and the beauty of Liverpool's attack at the moment is it is so unpredictable. And you've got those, I think Shaqiri can fill that, any one of those front three roles, really.
Yeah.
Whereas Sturridge kind of slows the play down a little bit. As you say, I like him too, but...
It's a systemic problem. It's not him. Really when he comes it? In, the system, it would be anybody. If anyone would come in, they would change that.
Yeah, I think it's, that weekend was definitely a massive point game for United, and definitely... 2 drop for Liverpool, because with United struggling that much physically, you would have really expected Liverpool to just go after them, and fair play to United. I think it was a really big point for them.
They defended really well as well. Yeah. I just want to say Lindelof was great.
What's impressed you about him in the last few?
Well, he can play with any partner. He's shown that already. Phil Jones, Chris Smalling. And also he's so good with the ball. And I'd never really saw that of him before.
But he took a lot of flack though this season up until very recently. And I think you're just seeing that he's actually a really, really good defender.
I was always in the Lindelof corner.
Yeah.
Always. And United, just very quickly, McTominay specifically, who played in defence midfield. When I saw the teams, I saw that Matic was out. And actually, funny enough, I think that worked in United's favour because Matic is a wonderful player, but when you run all over him, he doesn't have the legs to keep up with you. It's just a physical thing. It's a speed thing. McTominay is very light on his feet and very disciplined. I think sometimes too disciplined. I think sometimes his passing is not as ambitious as it could be. Mm. But I think he is capable of the transition pass. We saw that when United beat Chelsea 2-1 at Old Trafford last season, where he's very good at playing the ball out if he has to. The transition pass, but he was just so disciplined. And I want to mention him specifically because he's a player who's been criticised a lot, not without foundation a lot of the time, but he did add a lot to the game.
I thought he was the man of match. I thought
it was terrific.
Yeah,
I'd agree with that.
I thought he was really good and he added so much to United's midfield.
Solskjaer solved a lot of problems in the short time he's been at United.
Yeah, actually, for some more Solskjaer love, should we bring in Nish?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go for it. We are joined today on the Rabona podcast by the wonderful Nish Kumar, comedian, satirist, social commentator at large, currently on tour through the finer regions of the UK. Nish, so good to have you on and talk Manchester United.
Great to be here. Great to be in the Lowry Hotel, home of Jose Mourinho for 2.5 years. Great to be in the site of Jose Mourinho's Alan Partridge breakdown.
I think they're going to stick one of those blue plaques on that suite one day.
Yeah. It's really weird. It's really weird to be here because people, like, I mean, I don't think this extends to the staff, but everyone refers to it as the Mourinho Hotel. Like, when somebody asked me where I was staying, I was like, the Lowry Hotel, and they were like, oh, the Mourinho Hotel. Like, I can't decide whether it's been good or bad for the branding of this particular establishment.
It's incredible. It's actually the birthplace of William Blake, though, isn't it? I mean, he went through...
Yeah, if William Blake had been responsible for some tedious football.
I would read, listen, before we get into Solskjaer, I would definitely read a book of Mourinho's poetry.
Yeah.
I'd be very intrigued.
I'd be incredibly aggressive.
Yeah, handwritten. I want to see handwritten so we could analyse the sample. Anyway, sorry, we'll get into it. We'll get into United now because, you know, it's all about the positives in the future. Well, hopefully. Solskjaer, how are you feeling about him so far and how fair is it, do you think, to say that this is now his job to lose?
Okay, I think the PSG game was a good sort of reality check for right. all of us because yeah. we've all got a bit giddy. And PSG game was a real sort of reminder that he still has things to learn
right.
and steps to take to get to the kind of top level of management in the game. But I would give him the job. I think that he's actually shown much more tactical nous than he's maybe been given credit for. Some of the coverage of him, it's like, it sounds like he's like a competition winner. Like he's just like, he's so happy to be there. And he sort of, the game yesterday, I thought he managed in incredibly difficult circumstances. He managed really, really well. And I think that he's got more of a tactical acumen than he's being given credit for. I mean, I think the Spurs game at Wembley, when they went with the kind of diamond and the split forwards.
Right.
Was a really interesting piece of tactical thinking. And yesterday, when he sent them back out in a kind of rejigged 4-5-1, that spell 15 minutes after the half-time break was probably United's best spell in the game.
Yep.
And they really, for about 15 minutes against the odds, I actually thought controlled the game before fading a little bit. But I think he's got more tactical now than he's been given credit for. And I think that he, yesterday, showed that he's learning from experiences like the PSG game. I personally think it's his job to lose. I absolutely think that when you have a manager who the players respond to so positively and who shows themselves capable of learning and adjusting, I think that stands for a huge amount.
That's really interesting. Ryan, you want to jump in?
Yeah, Nish, I just wanted to ask you as a United fan how you are feeling now with regards to Solskjaer as opposed to when he took over. Would you imagine that it would have been this good at the time?
Definitely not. I mean, there's a sort of, because I'm 33 years old, because of the age that I am, I have a huge amount of nostalgic fondness for Solskjaer, obviously. Right. And he, you know, but some of that is just me wishing I was a teenager again. But actually, that would be a terrible idea. I had a terrible time the first time. I don't think I'd want to go.
Nick, I just wish I was 33 again, to be honest. Yeah.
So I have a tremendous amount of warm feeling towards him. And so I was happy that he was taking over in a sense, because I think the end of the Mourinho era was so poisonous that it felt like doing something just to reward the fans might be just tonic. But I can't pretend that I had any idea he was going to do such a good job.
I mean, it's been extraordinary.
Mm. Yeah, you know, it would be completely dishonest of me to say, yeah, I always saw this coming. I really didn't think that he would apply himself with and have this amount of success so short term. I really thought yesterday, of all of the things that he has done that have shown up the job Mourinho did, I think yesterday's game was the thing that would make Mourinho most angry. Because forget the kind of disjointed attacking and the sort of odd-shaped formations. Yesterday was an excellent defensive performance from United.
Right,
and it's the sort of thing that Mourinho was... His personal brand is built around performances like yesterday, where he has to rejig the team, but the kind of organisation at the back is second to none. And it was so odd watching United under Mourinho be... I mean, the game that did for him at Anfield, the defending was absolutely appalling. And yesterday, you've got Luke Shaw, a player who for large periods of Mourinho's tenure, he just seemed to take against. Luke Shaw snuffing out Mo Salah. Victor Lindelof looking like a kind of world-class centre-back.
Right, yeah. And,
you know, it's quite extraordinary. I thought yesterday's game was the most damning indictment of the Mourinho era, much more so than the more sort of explosive attacking displays.
I keep finding myself impressed by how Solskjaer deals with slight disappointments, you know, how he dealt with PSG, how he dealt with yesterday. And actually, he said that it was definitely a positive. It definitely felt like a point gain for United yesterday. And he was like, you know, we overcame the circumstances as opposed to, you know, just moaning about the injuries.
30 minutes in, you'd have absolutely just settled for 0-0, you know, but that seemed incredibly unlikely, particularly by the time Lingard was, you know, limping off. I do also think there's a couple of players like Alexis Sanchez being the number one that I don't think have a future with him. Because if Solskjaer was willing to bring on an essentially one-legged Jesse Lingard.
Right, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. He has so little in the squad in terms of depth. Which is again is an indictment on recruitment, and it's not that, you know, that's the Glazer Woodward aspect.
Absolutely.
One thing before I forget, and one question before you leave, and you tell us where you're going to be next on your travels. There's no shortage of professionals coming forward out of the woodwork now to hawk their services at United. No shortage of opportunists and shysters coming out of the woodwork to say, "Oh, give me this that job." At United now that, you know, Mourinho's gone. And I'm sure you're no different. So if Solskjaer were to employ you tomorrow, what job would you deserve at United?
I don't know. How's the... what's the current employment status of the guy inside Fred the Red? what's Fred the Red status? Is there room for Fred the Red? Not a second Fred the Red?
That would be
but
great.
Even then, Fred the Red actually has to run around quite a lot. So I'd probably say understudy to Fred the Red.
Would you have the fitness and the comic timing, though?
I mean, I would like to think I've got some level of comic timing, but my fitness would be a real issue. I think I struggle to I struggle to run around naked. Why would I do that?
Yeah, I imagine come May time being in that kind of polyester suit,
that's tough. Being in that Fred the Red costume is not going to be fun.
Well, Nish, that sounds great. I think you could be the missing piece of the dream team at United. But before you go, firstly, thank you so much for joining us. And secondly, where can we find you online and on tour?
I'm at Mr. Nish Kumar on Twitter. My website is nishkumar.co.uk, and I'm on tour in the United Kingdom until the 1st of April, and I'm all over the place, and the dates are all on my website.
Until April Fool's Day, that's incredible.
Well, yeah, I'm doing four shows that weekend, and bookending them are two shows at the Hackney Empire, one on March 29th and one on April 1st, and the eagle-eared amongst you will have registered that March 29th is the day of the UK.
Yeah, we're all nodding.
And then the 1st of April is not only April Fool's Day, but technically our first working day outside of the European Union. So, you know, I don't know. We're trying to organise two bouts of 1,000 lots of tinned goods.
Wonderful.
In the event of some sort of no-deal Brexit scenario.
Nish, this is an absolute joy. And I can only, my only regret is I won't be in the UK for these gigs because they sound, they're going to be an absolute cracker.
We won't be allowed to go. I'll sort our paperwork out.
Well, my brother is my brother's coming back. My brother is a resident of Berlin, and he is coming back for that weekend to see the shows. And there is still some doubt as to whether he'll be able to go home.
Oh no!
Oh man! Oh well, Nisha. Well, luckily you'll be in the country and you'll be performing, and you'll be brilliant, I'm sure, as always. Check him out, listeners, if you haven't already. He's one of our very best talents. Nish, an absolute joy, and I hope to see you soon enough.
Lovely to speak to you guys. Take care.
Thanks so much, man.
Thanks, Nish.
Cheers, Nish.
And we're back from the break, and we have to talk about Leo Messi because Leo Messi is underrated. Leo Messi is still underrated.
He is. I've been doing a little research. Thought I'd bring it with me.
Oh, here we go.
Michael Destato.
This one was going around 50 career hat-tricks now.
My goodness.
36 goals in 35 games just against Sevilla.
Poor Sevilla.
650 goals, 267 assists in 797 games.
I mean...
And he has five Ballon d'Ors, nine La Ligas, six Copa del Reyes, and four Champions Leagues.
Hasn't won a World Cup though, mate. So what a fraud.
Overrated.
What a bottler.
Asterisk.
Yeah, it was an amazing hat trick. And I mean, they were all great goals. The first one, I've got news for you guys. He shinned it.
Here we go.
I've watched it.
Do you know what? That's fair play because that's harder to do.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
I've watched that replay about 17 times.
You sound like a truther.
And he
a messy truther.
He caught the lower part of his shin. It was
Michael's got the proof on the wall like that. Always Sunny.
That volley was so wild because he places it in the top corner
with
he
his shin. It. Yeah. It's so fantastic. I know.
Do you know what? Messi can't even get any love. We're having this podcast. We're talking about.
It's not a criticism. If anything, it's proof of his genius. But yeah, he was absolutely unplayable in that game. But he's unplayable every game. We just take it for granted now.
But here's the wild thing. So I watched back the performance and I was looking at it. Actually, until he scores the goal, poor Sevilla, they defend him really well.
Yeah.
He actually is not really doing much with the goal. So he tries a lot of these like 1-2 passes into space in a typical Messi crossfield try shots. They close him down so well because what Sevilla have realized is Messi is human and great players have off days. So of course what you do with a great player is you basically hit him early, not hit him like physically, but like you crowd him early in the game, don't let him develop a rhythm, and you basically like knock him off balance and hope he has a bad game, which he's done in Champions League.
But
just to throw this in, the second he gets space and scores that volley after that, and you look at every touch he makes since then, every run, every move, and it's like he just locks in and then he just slaughters him.
For most players, that kind of defending would be absolutely fine.
Right.
You know, you wouldn't expect him to absolutely thrash it into the top corner like he does.
Yeah.
But it's also the second goal was great, right foot, you know, curls it into the top corner. And the last goal where time just seems to stand still.
Do you know what, right? Do you remember those like old 80s films that would have dogs in and they'd always do like a view from the dog's perspective and everything's a little bit like different.
Yes.
Like, I wonder if Messi's like that where everything's just slowed down or in like... night vision, because he seems to do stuff like all of those finishes were like he didn't have any time to do any of them, and he was just slowing everything down.
The cross for the third goal was coming in and the keeper was already scrambling to get into position. Messi was virtually standing still, almost playing in his head what was going to happen before it happened. It was staggering. And then so casually, or it seems so casual, but it's actually such a difficult score.
Well, because Lingard had the same scenario, slightly closer in against Alisson. I didn't go for the chip, tried to go round him.
Mm.
And, you know, different situation, a different player might have just lifted it over him.
Can I give a shout out to Ousmane Dembele, though? Because Barcelona looked a lot better when he came on the weekend.
As always.
Yeah. And he doesn't get enough praise, I don't think. I think you're seeing, you know, a tale of two expensive signings, and they're very different. In Philippe Coutinho is not having a good time at Barca, and he's I think it's getting to the point where they're going to, I'm going to have to look to move him on in the summer, I think, because it's just not really...
He doesn't link the play.
Yeah.
I want to say about Messi before I forget, you're very right on Coutinho. And I saw, I think, Kevin Williams on Twitter saying that he felt that Alenia was a much better fit because he sews together the midfield a lot better. And, you know, Dembele's been great because Dembele is, again, you know, the sort of slightly, people are suspicious of slightly sort of free-looking, wide player who doesn't do much defensive work, but, I mean, scoring vital goals. One thing I want to quickly say about Messi is that if you look at Messi's average position, and maybe we can sort of maybe ask sort of the stats zone team about this at some point. If you look at Messi's average position on the pitch, I'm not sure he's a striker anymore. He's like probably the world's highest scoring number eight because the positions he takes up, I watched it back and I was like, am I right? Am I being crazy here? I went back over Messi's performance. The amount of times he comes and takes the ball off the centre backs.
Yeah, can I cut in here? Because I did see his heat map.
Oh, wow.
From the Sevilla game.
Yeah.
And it was very orange for quite a lot of the pitch. So you're right.
He's 31, and it's inevitable that he's gonna drop deeper. Right?
We're gonna be in 5 years' time. We're gonna be talking about the age of the sweeper when Leo is playing up behind Umtiti and Longley as a sweeper. He's gonna revolutionise the game again.
We realise it was just Messi.
Yeah,
we'll look back. And, I mean, he literally plays as an eight. He plays the position that David Silva and Bernardo Silva are playing.
Do you know what though? He's getting to the stage of his career. He's 31. I'm starting to fear the end. I'm fearing life after Messi, you know, because it's a reality. Very soon.
Who else will distract us from the abyss?
We've got Jadon to keep our mind off it all.
Sancho Corner.
Let's move over to Sancho Corner.
Sancho Corner.
Take a seat. We've got some stats.
Ooh, let's go for it.
Shout out to StatZone. We don't even have to go and search for them anymore. StatZone are very kindly tweeting us Sancho stats every week. saves us at least a 20-second job.
They love the Sancho corner.
Jadon Sancho versus Bayer Leverkusen. Two shots, both on target, one goal. Four chances created, one assist. 9 out of 9 attacking third passes completed.
That's off the scale. The thing about these final third passing stats, which is wild, is that, look, only a few years ago, it was completely fine before, I think, stats were recorded, to be quite wasteful in the final third, you know, try things that don't come off. But now we have this age of efficiency. You look at someone like Raheem Sterling, right? The amount of times Raheem Sterling recycles possession when a cross gets overhit and Sterling will collect it and then get the ball back in. Mm. You saw Bernardo Silva do it in the League Cup final. The amount of times Bernardo Silva dribbles into coverage of two or three players and retains possession and comes back out with it. I mean, it's just on a different level now.
You know what? Yeah, that's absolutely right. And Sterling is, what is he, 24 now?
Raheem the Dream.
Something like
that. Yeah, Raheem the Dream. I love that. That's got to be a thing.
I'm surprised it's not.
Well, it is now. Raheem the Dream.
Raheem the Dream Sterling. Sorry, Michael.
The thing about Sterling is that he's now quite an experienced player. You know, he's built up that skill over many years of being able to keep the ball, be efficient with the ball in the final third and make the right pass, a correct pass. Sancho's doing all that at the age of 18.
It's wild, isn't it?
I don't think I've been this excited about a young English player since, well, Sterling, but probably Rooney.
But what makes Sancho so exciting is the peak is not in sight.
Yeah.
You know, this is the thing. We said about Sterling before, and he's now achieving his potential.
Yeah.
He still has even better to get. I think he's that good. Sancho is just, it's the maturity, the decision-making, the variety of goals that he scores.
And we've seen that evolve like in front of our very eyes this season. Right. It's like every game he just seems to learn something and get better. And he's had an advantage that he's had an almost unbroken run in the team. But that's obviously a result of his goals and assists. But he's learning. And that's
what it feels like being in Germany now with Sancho. It feels like, you know, those people that get to see the Arctic Monkeys early gigs, you know, like, you know, when they were playing around the corner before they're really famous. It feels like that. It feels like it's a privilege, because we saw the early development. Everyone's like, oh, Sancho, is that good? No, we're really, no. And then people see him play for England.
Yeah.
And then he gets more coverage. And we're like, we told you, we can just be there.
I know a few people in England who don't seem to really appreciate quite how good he is, because maybe they've only seen one England game that he played in,
right,
and perhaps Dortmund versus Spurs the other day when he was good in the first half but then got shut out in the second. I'm looking forward to people in England realising just how good he is.
There's been so many rumours recently about him going to Man United, and this is nothing to do with Man United, but I really, really don't want that to happen. I don't want him to move.
I want Sancho to be one of these English players, and I really can't really think of one that this has happened to before, who's never gone back to England.
I actually don't want him to go to United either, and I love Sancho, and that's why I don't want him to go, because I feel that if you have those young players all in the same squad, They won't all get regular playing time. Mm. It will disrupt their careers. And I think he deserves a place to shine. He's earned it. I want him to go somewhere like
Barca. Barca, him on one side, Dembele on the other side.
Yeah, it has to be, if he moves, and I think Dortmund's the right place for him, by the way, but if he moves for a year or two, but if he moves, it has to be somewhere he's going to actually play.
Yeah.
Right. Do you know what? I can actually see him staying in Germany and going to Bayern.
No, that'd be horrific. You know what Pep would do? Pep would buy him for Barca. Pep's brain, Pep or Cruyff. Cruyff, it's galaxy brain Cruyff, would put a midfield three at Barca of Messi, Arthur, and Frankie de Jong.
Frankie, yeah.
The two wingers, right? Sancho and Dembele. And then and buy another nine.
Kane.
And that, yeah, right. And that, I'm sorry I didn't want to say it in front of Michael, but that's what I was thinking. But that team
but he's one
would
of our
devour
own.
Everything. Would that team not eat everything
reject.
In sight?
Yeah, no, he totally, yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
because Messi's going to be an eight. He's going to become an eight, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Atleti didn't concede again, just in case you're wondering.
Morata I mean, scored.
Yeah, Morata got his first goal.
Oh, good for him. What a lovely man.
After having one disallowed as well.
He looked, when he scored, there was this moment Morata was like going around and like, oh, is this real? Is this actually happening?
Yeah.
And then it's, you know, he's obviously very popular already and he has that sort of really amazing work ethic. Shout out to Griezmann because Sid Lowe said, Griezmann is so underrated. I want to say, listen, I'm always team Griezmann.
Yeah.
I think he's an extraordinary player.
Just quickly, what do you think of Atletico's chances in the Champions League this year? Because since our last podcast, they picked up a really big 2-0 win over Juve.
Thomas Lemar needs to take off. They need him. Yeah. They need him. They need Thomas Lemar, like Real Madrid needed Di Maria in 2014. They need him to be a game breaker. Yeah. That's their final hurdle, I think.
Yeah. Finals in at the Wanda this year as well.
Yeah. So let's go.
Incentive.
I'm delighted to welcome to the Rabona podcast Guardian women's football writer Susie Rack. Susie, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
You were at the game on the weekend, the Conti Cup final, which is the Women's League Cup final between Arsenal and Manchester City. The only two sides to have won the competition since it was rebranded. Wanted to see what your thoughts were. It was another League Cup final that was 0-0 and went to penalties, and ultimately Man City won it.
Yeah, I mean, it was fairly straightforward when you went into it. Man City were the kind of clear favourites in the. At the moment, they're unbeaten in domestic competitions. They've got a really strong squad. They've got most of them, like 90% of their players are fit, whereas Arsenal are kind of absolutely decimated by injury. And they've got 7+ first team starters sitting in the stands watching most games at the moment. And the bench said it all. City, a bench of 6 outfield players, plus a keeper filled with international talent. Arsenal had 3 outfield teenagers from their academy with no international experience at all, and Vivian Miedema, who is obviously their star striker, top scorer in the league this season, but was only fit enough for the bench herself. So it was an uneven contest straight from the off, and in that sense it was very impressive that Arsenal kind of held out for as long as they did and managed to go the 120 minutes without conceding, because Man City have best defensive record in the league. Arsenal's isn't fantastic, and they, you know, they have struggled against Chelsea and Man City recently, and so it was real kind of solid defensive performance. They set up very defensively, which is very kind of un-Arsenal at the moment, and Leah Williamson and Louise Quinn were absolutely incredible at the back, and Sari Van Veenendaal, the goalkeeper, was had one of the games of her career, arguably. I think Karen Bardsley afterwards, City goalkeeper, praised her quite a lot. You know, said it's it can be a big mental challenge when your opposite number is having the game of their lives, and you've got very little to do to maintain that focus and not think that this is going to be their moment when they're having that game, because you know as a keeper that when you're having the game of your life, you feel like it's going to go your way. So that's the mindset you've got. You're standing there. And it's very much a mental game rather than a physical game with the outfield players. It's, really interesting comment.
I wanted to touch on Leah Williamson because you mentioned her before. And she's someone who is making real waves for Arsenal. She's only 21 years old. I think that was that her 7th final already for Arsenal?
Yeah, she's fantastic. I mean, she's got a huge amount of pace. She reads the game really well. And then she's absolutely brilliant at playing out from the back. And she, like you say, she's 21. She's been at Arsenal a long time. And what's evident, speaking to her after the game and previously, is her passion for Arsenal, her family.
Yeah.
support Arsenal. You know, she's played for them since she was a kid, and she cares. You can feel it. She really cares. I mean, she was gutted to have missed that penalty. It was almost, you know, she was very much. Kind of her performance before that was irrelevant in those moments after the game. You know, she was absolutely devastated. But the thing is she was fantastic in that game. And I think, you know, it's hard that it had to, you know, end the way it did with her penalty miss.
She seems to be incredibly wise beyond her years, like the way she talks about the game, the way she talks about her game specifically as well.
Mm.
Every time I read anything about her, I just think, coach.
Yeah, Jo Mintz-Murray said it after the match. She said she's got the maturity of a 30-year-old, and you know, saying I think she's massively underrated. I actually think she is as rated as she should be quite widely now. But yeah, she's just superbly mature. I've also similarly thought she's got to go into coaching afterwards. You never know which kind of way people will go, but she's definitely got the mind for it. She asks the right questions of her coaching staff, of her players, and of herself, and is always wanting to develop and improve, but is constantly questioning the reasons why things haven't gone right or what has worked in a way that's just incredibly thoughtful.
So the final with the two top teams in the FA Women's Super League, Man City are currently top 2 points ahead of Arsenal, where Arsenal have two games in hand. As you said, decimated with injuries. How do you see it playing out? What's your gut feeling on it? Because it now takes a break for a couple of weeks. Do you expect them to get some players back soon?
Yeah, I mean, you'd hope so. You'd hope. I don't know if Vivian Miedema is going to travel with the Netherlands. I sort of hope she doesn't. I think she desperately needs a rest. I'm not sure what the time frame is for Leah Walty and Emma Mitchell to come back, but they both, I know, were kind of slight possibles ahead of the final. So hopefully they'll be back and able to kind of spark a bit of life back into Arsenal. But my heart says Arsenal, my head says Man City for the title. There's an incredible desire amongst the Arsenal players to win that league now. They've got no other distractions, whereas City are still in the FA Cup. So there is that. But City are just so brutally efficient at the moment, and they don't look like they're gonna drop points. Whereas Arsenal, kind of late post Christmas, have really been grinding out results a little bit in a way that they just didn't have at the start of the year. They were just kind of swaggering all over the pitch early on. Now they're being made to work. So it's just whether they can hold out. I think as long as they get Champions League football, as long as they get top two, then they'll be satisfied with the season. Obviously not taking any silverware away would be a blow, but they've not had Champions League football now for, I think, this sort of 4 or 5 years or something, and you know, have such a rich history in the competition, being the only English side to have won that tournament. So you know, I think as long as they get Champions League football, that they'll feel like this season hasn't been so right off. But without that, it's going to be that'd be a massive blow.
And just a quick one before we let you go. You're off to the She Believes Cup this week.
I am, yes.
For those who don't know what it is, do you maybe fancy giving us a little bit of a breakdown? Because it's a cool little tournament.
Yeah, so it's a friendly tournament. And usually, you know, you kind of could be a bit dismissive of most friendly tournaments. But it's actually got a bit of bite to it, because it's usually some of the top teams in the world playing over three days of double headers. So this time round, it's in its fourth year, and it's always been used as a kind of big tournament, a test of teams that are kind of fight for titles. So for the World Cup, it's a massive test of England, particularly as they play the US, obviously, who hosts the tournament, and are holders of the World Cup, and Japan, who were the runners up to the US last time out. And are in England's group. So that's a really, really good indication of just, you know, how competitive England will be at the World Cup. Obviously, you know, Jill Scott's not going because she's having a rest, and there's other players that will be back in time for the World Cup itself that won't be out in the US. But in terms of an overall idea of kind of the level that England are at ahead of the summer, it's a really good indication. It's a really great great tournament. There's three games. They play Brazil first, then the US, and then Japan. And like I say, you know, having such high level opposition in the run up to a World Cup, I think, is really, really important. All the games are being shown on TV as well, on BBC Two or BBC Four, which I think is a big boost.
Yeah,
a nice change too.
Susie, before you go, can you just maybe let people know where they can check your stuff?
Yeah, so I'm obviously writing weekly for The Guardian. Every Tuesday I have a women's football column go up, and and then I'm at most games, so you can find on the Guardian website and in the newspaper.
Brilliant. Susie, thanks so much for joining us.
Brilliant. No problem. Cheers.
After Real Madrid's outrageous VAR penalty decision that won them the game at Levante.
This is Casemiro, right?
And the fact that it went to VAR and didn't get overturned.
Yeah, it was a shocking dive from Casemiro.
Yeah, really bad. We got a question from Hamdan. What do you think would be the next step in the evolution of VAR? The recent controversy in La Liga has got me thinking that VAR needs to evolve from its current form of usage, which I 100% agree with, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just that game as well. In the last few days, we saw Schalke versus Man City, where it pretty much ruined the first half and had a detrimental effect on Schalke's chances, I think. Mm. For me, it has to, I think that the technology has to work quickly and efficiently. If it doesn't, then it slows down the game, and the speed and, you know, the flow of football is probably its secret kind of ingredient, you know. So we saw at the same time, Atletico Juve, VAR was used two or three times, and it was just done quickly, and it didn't really affect the play. In the Schalke game, it was done. The official response was that there was a technical.
Oh yeah, the screen didn't work.
Yeah. So yeah, I think VAR is great if it's used for it only, though, if it's used for firstly key moments that are black and white. So offside, disallowed goals, whatever, but it has to be quick as well.
I think that actually the speed that they watch the replays back has to be addressed, because the problem with VAR is that if you watched me playing football at the speed they watch the replays back, I'd look amazing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not very trustworthy in that sense, is that speed is a big gauge for whether you can award a lot of decisions or not, especially in handball. So if you slow a handball down, every handball is going to look like a handball when it's not. And I think that's the problem with it. Every foul looks like a foul, or every challenge looks like a foul.
Yeah.
Even where you exaggerate contact, it can look like a worse foul when you slow it down.
True.
So that I think that's a problem with it as well.
I think if VAR is going to be truly effective, it needs to work on an appeal system like we see in other sports. You know, Spurs were undone at the weekend with a corner at Burnley that should have been a goal kick. And if Vertonghen is absolutely sure that that's a goal kick, then he tells Lloris. Lloris makes the challenge. It's successful and they keep that challenge. Yeah. And maybe one challenge a half, something like that.
That's good. That's really good, actually. Smart, practical solution.
What always gets me with VAR is that FIFA introduced goal line technology, but they really had to have their arm twisted about that for a long, long time because they were worried how it would affect the game, the speed of the game. So they introduced that and then quickly introduced VAR, which wasn't tried and tested. I think their decision making was a bit off there, but they need to fix it. Right. And if it's fixed, it could be really beneficial.
While we're on the questions, should we do we've got a few other questions.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Let's
do them.
So this one is from Eric Renko at Eric Renko. What do you think happened in Chelsea's locker room after the cup final? And what do you think will happen next with Sarri?
I think Kepa just grabbed his bags and ran for a taxi.
I think Sarri played the diplomat. I don't think there was a slanging match, given how he handled it in the press conference. I think he took that same move to the dressing room, just me projecting here. And I think he just kept it light.
Did you notice before the penalty shootout that Rudiger kind of took Sarri to one side and was just saying to him, like, well, I can only assume what he was saying, but it must have been, don't blow up over this, you know, trying to calm him down. So maybe, maybe Sarri had kind of cooled at that point.
I think it was quite sedate afterwards.
He also strikes me as the kind of guy that, whilst he would have been really angry in the moment, I can't imagine him being that fond of just launching into someone in the dressing room.
Also, he knows his current standing at Chelsea is on kind of unstable ground a little bit, so he has to pick his battles, but it would have taken a lot for him to bite his tongue over that one.
I reckon Zola was the one who would have gone mental, actually.
Wow, that's a good shout. And as well, you know what's funny about the Zola thing? Because Zola, you can see him, he's someone who really respects the institution of the club. Yeah. And the disbelief he had on the bench was really something. I think he looked genuinely hurt by it.
I think Sarri, I feel a little sorry for him in some ways because he's made mistakes tactically and all that. And we've discussed that on previous podcasts. But he deserves time and he deserves respect and space to be able to rectify that. and it's still his first season. I know that means something different at Chelsea, but I feel it's something a bit distasteful about how he's being treated at Chelsea.
I just hope he gets the payoff. I hope he gets sacked and gets the big payoff. I don't want him to get sacked, but I hope sacked as opposed to leaving of his own volition. I just hope he gets that payoff. I think he deserves it.
Another question?
Yep, sure.
This one's from Polar Bear.
Oh, the great poet, Stephen Camden, the great writer.
Who is / was the last great, in capitals, number nine?
Ooh. Robert Lewandowski.
Do they have to wear number nine?
It's the state of mind, the nine. Nine is the kind of, when I say nine, I say the arrowhead, the absolute tip of an attack where it's a 4-4-2 or a 4-5-1. That person that plays at the apex, who does a limited amount of link-up work, not because they can't, but because they're actually like always edge of the six-yard box to the edge of the penalty box.
Yeah.
That is their domain. That to me is Lewandowski.
You know who was great at that? He probably not the last one, but Gary Lineker. Absolutely superb.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
He did rarely involved in link-up play. Like, I mean, he would drop back a little bit and make the odd pass out wide, but he was all about finishing.
He's actually underrated.
Within 10, 12 yards.
Lineker's underrated. And I say this because there was an interview where Marcelo Salas, when he was starting to peak for Chile and just before he moved to Lazio, was compared to Lineker. And Salas was like a child. He was just so excited by the comparison. That is the level he's held at. And I think it's because Lineker's understanding of space, which I think he shares with actually someone like Hernan Crespo, you know, Hernan Crespo and Gary Lineker were, in terms of understanding space in the penalty box and delivering these astonishing sort of close-range finishes. I mean, yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
What about someone like Zlatan? Or is he too involved?
Zlatan, it was funny because I saw him as like a kind of, people hate the expression, a 9.5. I know what they mean, because if you look at his first season at Juve, he scored like 16 goals, I think, but he was an incredible playmaker, an amazing passer.
Yeah.
So almost really a deep-lying forward who did score now and again. Drogba, you know, Drogba's another one of the pure nines.
Yeah.
Of course, the great phenomenon, Ronaldo. You mentioned before the podcast, actually, Michael, Gabriel Batistuta.
He was pure nine.
He's a pure nine. This is what I mean. When we say a pure nine, we mean somebody who is basically playing primarily on the front foot, whose instinct is not to drop deep and link play, but just to be crashing the near post. You know, for me, the definition of a number nine, actually, let's just get into it. A number nine is someone who attacks the near post, because actually a striker's instinct is to go not sort of in where it hurts, but in where the margin is the toughest. So a true nine for me is the one that attacks the thing I hate most in football, the in-swinging corner. You know, to attack the blinking ball, as they call it, the ball that comes to a crowd of players' legs. That's the true nine.
Yeah, I think Jermaine Defoe has a shout as well.
Yeah.
He doesn't quite fit all of those qualities, but he was just only about scoring goals.
Right.
So yeah, going back to the question of today's number nines, I think we're agreed, Lewandowski, right?
Just my answer is I don't know. I actually don't know.
You don't know?
I don't think I know.
Oh my goodness, that's really humble not to offer an opinion. I mean, I'm
too overwhelmed by this question.
Do you know what I love about these questions? My brain just fills with football and I become speechless because my brain becomes like 1,000 YouTube videos.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to say thanks to everyone who reached out about last week's podcast. We got some lovely comments about it. And yeah, please, as ever, if you listen to the podcast on iTunes, rate and review, preferably 5 stars.
Shout out to Adam Green, who I actually met, a real life fan, I met in real life, the podcast, who's here with the lovely Yassi. They're here for a few days in Berlin. And they didn't just praise the analysis, they loved the sound quality.
Oh.
And that's something. So yeah, Adam Green, loving the sound quality. Thank you, Ryan. You're doing a great job.
I actually think I need to do it better. But, you know, thanks very much.
So humble. So that wraps up for another week. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. You can find us at Rabona Mag. All social media handles.
Actually, before we go, the second Rabona Selects went up on the Rabona Twitter account, at Rabona Mag on Twitter.
Ooh. Ryan, do you want to just quickly explain
Moussa
what Selects is all about?
Huge description of that last week, but quickly, it's
just
basically...
for anyone that missed the show last week.
Some of our favourite football highlights with some better music. Is that the best way to do it? But we basically pick a tune that works with that player and there's a reason why, and then we post them every week. So there'll be another one this week.
We're a bit sick of great football highlights to terrible techno music.
Yeah, although we also got a copyright infringement last week. Gonna have to watch that. That just means I'm gonna have to go for more underground stuff, which is cool.
Awesome.
But yeah, if you want to watch some Thierry Henry with Hugh Masekela, head to the Rabona Twitter account.
Good stuff. Well, thanks so much for listening once again, and catch you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.